Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the demonstrations that took place in Moscow over the weekend against war with Ukraine and speak with Russian journalist and author Masha Gessen about the other Russia that is opposed to Putin, who is riding high in the polls. She is the author of the bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and her latest book is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. She also has an article in The Washington Post, Putin Wins in Russia Only by Escalating His War Rhetoric. Then we'll look into the political recriminations in Asia between a furious Chinese government and the authoritarian and apparently inept Malaysian government over the disappearance of a Beijing-bound Malaysian airliner with 239 people aboard, 153 of whom are Chinese, including a delegation of prominent artists. Michael Buehler, a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University, who has contributed to political risk evaluations for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia, joins us to discuss the internal politics of Malaysia and bureaucratic infighting that may have led to unnecessary confusion and a week's delay in calling off a fruitless search in the wrong ocean. Then finally, we will speak with an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK, David Gleave, who will analyse the possible scenarios that might explain the actions of the plane after it was diverted from its scheduled flight path and where the Boeing 777 may have ended up, what may have happened to the passengers, as well as what may be the intentions of those behind involved in the plane's hijacking, whether suicide for insurance, theft for ransom, or a flying bomb for future use by a terrorist group. And joining us now is Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently their national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And her latest article at The Washington Post is Putin Wins in Russia Only by Escalating His War Rhetoric. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masha Gessen.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
And the other Russia showed up over the weekend on Saturday. 50,000 people showed up in the streets of Moscow. The term the other Russia came from Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who spoke in Kiev recently at the Maidan. What was your sense then? I mean, the piece that you wrote in the Washington Post, I think, ends rather ominously, and I'm afraid I share your concern that Putin is intent on invading eastern Ukraine simply because he's changed the subject. The Sochi Olympics changed the subject, and now he's riding in the polls, and as long as people in Russia are feeling macho and about going to war and fighting the fascists again, they're not thinking about Putin's corruption.
Exactly right. And Putin faced a mass protest movement as he was coming into the office of president for the third time 2 years ago, and his ratings, his approval ratings, which fell as the protest movement began, never fully recovered until he invaded Ukraine. This was the mobilization effort that finally got the country excited again and got the country to back Putin again. Now, the problem with the with popularity that's won that way is that you have to keep escalating. And the other thing to understand that's very important is that once the Crimea joins the Russian Federation, which seems pretty much a done deed, the makeup of the Russian Federation will change, which, according to the Russian Constitution, necessitates a new presidential election. So Putin gets to renew his six-year term. But that means he's going to be campaigning for the next few months. And that means he needs to keep the war effort going. He needs to keep people excited about the war effort. That means he needs to keep escalating. He also will need to keep escalating in response to any economic sanctions that the West imposes. So all signs point to his having to do this. Now, As for the protesters, I'm very proud of the thousands of people who went into the streets of Moscow yesterday. According to the organizers, there were 70,000 people. According to the police, there were 3,000 people. According to the person counters at the metal detectors, as people entered the march, there were 23,000 people, which is probably roughly the correct number. That's a lot of people. In a country that is showing overwhelming support for the war effort, that's a lot of people. But the thing to understand about it is that this was a legal protest. This was the protest that happened according to the rules that are imposed by the Russian government. It happens in a cordoned off space where people are talking to themselves. But in exchange for agreeing to do it in this very strange format, they're basically guaranteed their safety. Putin will stop allowing these kinds of protests, I think, very, very soon, just as basically he has moved in and cracked down on the internet last week by shutting off access to the most popular opposition resources, something that hadn't happened in Russia before, something that people were afraid of for years, but something that only happened in connection with the war effort. So he allowed the steam valve to function for the weekend for people who lost access to the opposition news and commentary resources that they were used to go out into the streets to show their solidarity with Ukrainians, to say all the right things. And I very much doubt that this will happen again. And the sense in the crowd was also that this was the last time that people were going out into the streets, being able to say what they have to say and being able to see each other.
Well, of course, this manifestation of up to 70,000 people in the streets, the rest of the country didn't know about it, right? The Putin-controlled press, I imagine, didn't cover it at all.
State television didn't mention it at all. This is actually also a novelty. In the past, they would say that there was a protest march or a demonstration. They would downplay the numbers. They would say something offensive about the demonstrators. This time, they did nothing of the sort. It's like it never happened. So, yes, for 98% of the country, for the people who get their information from state-controlled television, nothing happened. This is something that also the rules of protest guarantee, right? People are talking to themselves. They're in this cordoned-off area. The entire route of the march was closed off, so there were police cordons all along the street. So it's not like you would, in a Western city, you would have accidental onlookers on the sidewalk seeing the march. Nothing of the sort. The only people who knew there was a march happening were the people who were participating in the march. And with the loss of the opposition news resources on the internet, other people wouldn't even have even been able to learn what happened or seen the pictures. So the only outlet for that are those kind of social networks. It's very much back to person-to-person connections.
Again, I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And her latest article at the Washington Post is Putin Wins in Russia Only by Escalating His War Rhetoric. So just following through your scenario, Masha, as grim as it is, but I think it's very plausible. And it's very hard in covering this situation has been to separate the geopolitical from the personal, because Putin is the new czar. And I think Yanukovych fleeing the palace, I think really did affect him psychologically, because he's stolen so much more than Yanukovych has and has many more palaces than Yanukovych has. I talked to a Russian expert on the who's been advising the last three American presidents on Russia, Angela Stent, and she said she was with Putin when he learned of the fate of Gaddafi, and she said he was really personally freaked out by that hideous end for Gaddafi. So he can string this out for a long time. My understanding is, from Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent defense analyst, is that So the spring is not the best time for tanks to roll into Ukraine because they could sink in the mud up to their turrets. So is he likely to just sort of send these thugs across the border and destabilize the place and keep this thing fermenting for a while until the summer?
I think that's a pretty good those are two good points. One is, yes, absolutely, Putin sees in Ukraine more than any other country a reflection of Russia. So it plays into his general feeling that he's under threat. He's been feeling under threat since the protest movement started, and he feels like there are protesters in Ukraine who are American-inspired, just as he believes that of the Russian protesters, who succeeded in overthrowing a ruler that he identifies with. Right? So that contributes to his general feeling of being under siege and being surrounded by enemies. This is very much his politics. His politics is about communicating to Russia that Russia is a country under siege, surrounded by enemies, always having to fight, always having to mount a war effort in order to be able to stay stable. So it's a very organic feeding of his fears into sort of the national fears, and he's a very good reflection of the national psyche in this sense. Now, as far as how soon and how fast he's going to do it, the fact that spring is not the best time to send tanks into Ukraine does not mean that Putin is not going to send tanks into Ukraine. I mean, Putin is not known for acting in the smartest and most professional way, partly because the circle of decision makers is extremely small, extremely closed, and it is not apparent that he has somebody who is literate enough in matters of infantry warfare advising him and having the courage to tell him that now is not a good time to go in. So I wouldn't rule it out. But I think, yes, the scenario where he destabilizes Ukraine, where he keeps playing cat and mouse with the West and saying, you know, we're there, we're not there, I'm going in, I'm not going in, that can go on for a long time. He's going to watch for other opportunities to open up. He's going to do his best to sort of create situations where Russian intervention in one city or another is required, as happened with the murder of a protester, apparently pro-Russian protester, we don't know very much about this, in Donetsk the other day. An incident like this can be used as pretext for actually sending in Russian troops, or he can continue to send in thugs in unmarked uniforms to keep rocking the boat.
Well, Masha Gessen, I mean, I think the idea of pogroms against Russians in former Soviet states like the Baltics, where Russians had been there for decades and lost their citizenship, they lost homes and positions in the south, in the Kazakhstan and other areas when they became independent. It does resonate with Russians, doesn't it? I mean, he's dealing with a sense of loss, which apparently he feels very strongly, that the greatest geopolitical catastrophe was the end of the Soviet Union. That's apparently his geopolitical outlook. But that resonates with the Russian people, does it not?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what makes for effective propaganda, is a kernel of truth. Some of what Putin has told his people about Ukraine is true. There is some tension in some areas of Ukraine between ethnic Russians and Ukrainians, or more specifically between people whose dominant language is Ukrainian and people whose dominant language is Russian. There's in other post-Soviet states, not so much in Ukraine, but in other post-Soviet states, there have been significant problems with discrimination against Russian speakers in the population. There certainly is a radical right-wing nationalist element in the new coalition in Ukraine. Some of the protesters in Maidan were motivated by this. I mean, that's part of the Ukrainian phenomenon, is that Yanukovych, through his corruption and through his utter inability to listen to his people, managed to create a very diverse political coalition that included, among other people, this far-right-wing faction. So all of that is true. None of that is a valid reason to invade another country to use military force and to annex parts of another state. And this is something that is very much missing from the conversation in Russia. Rule of law as an idea, respect for international law as a concept, those things have been absent in Russian discourse for many, many years. So they don't even enter the conversation. It's a very, very basic conversation about, you know, having our brothers under attack in another country, so we have to go in and beat them up. It's the way you would talk about it in the schoolyard.
Well, Masha Gessen, it seems to me that, that you know, having John McCain stand next to the leader of Svoboda, the Freedom Party, the right-wing party in Ukraine that has a far greater representation in this new government than its polling and electoral numbers indicate. I don't know why on the Western side they don't repudiate these right-wingers and therefore take some of that ammunition away from Putin. But my understanding is, as Garry Kasparov, the chess master and dissident, says, that Putin's afraid of banks, not tanks. Why not, you know, I mean, they can extend the Magnitsky Act to Putin. And I don't understand why the West doesn't treat him like the thief and the gangster that he is. Because gangsters and criminals always crave respect, and we give him respect for free.
I can tell you why the West doesn't do it. I don't think it's a good reason, but I understand what the reason is. There's an idea that by pushing Putin further away, by treating him as the rogue actor that he is, the West would push him further in the direction of being a rogue actor. And this is true. I mean, the economic sanctions that actually work against Russia, and these aren't necessarily sanctions that would work personally against Putin, because Putin doesn't have that many assets in his own name, and he doesn't actually go west that much. Economic sanctions that would, you know, see Russia getting kicked off the London Stock Exchange, that see Russian businesses blocked from operations with U.S. currency, all of this is real and possible. This would really hit the Russian economy. What would that lead to? That would lead to greater mobilization. Russia has a mobilization economy as it is. Russia has been spending a lot of defense for the last several years at the expense of education, at the expense of social services. Now it has the perfect excuse to do so and to go further in that direction, and that's exactly what we're seeing happening. If economic sanctions hasten the slowdown of the Russian economy, that's what we're talking about, right? We're already seeing an economy that's slowing down. It can slow down faster under the impact of economic sanctions. That would mean greater mobilization of the Russian economy, and that would mean ratcheting up the war rhetoric. So in that sense, the argument that this will push Putin further in the direction of escalating his war effort and his war rhetoric is correct. I don't think that's a reason not to do it, because at this point, the West has no tools that would work strategically. Symbolic actions do not work. They open the West up to ridicule as far as Putin is concerned. The military response is not on the table. So all we're really talking about is economic sanctions. And the only argument against economic sanctions is that it would create a backlash. But anything the West does will create a backlash. So it's time to stop thinking strategically and start doing the right thing. The right thing to do is to treat Putin as the thug that he is and to make him into the pariah state that he deserves to be.
Well, Masha Gessen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She's contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and Masha has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And her latest article at the Washington Post is Putin Wins in Russia Only by Escalating His War Rhetoric. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the makeup of the Malaysian government, who appear to have messed up things, shall we say, over this disappearing jet.
Like it,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Buehler, who is a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society in New York City. He has contributed to political risk evaluations for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Buehler.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Michael. And the Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak, he came out of the woodwork somewhat late on this growing political scandal over the disappearance of the passenger jet on its way to Beijing. There were 153 Chinese aboard, including a high-level delegation of prominent Chinese artists. And the Chinese public and the Chinese government are furious that a whole week was wasted searching in the wrong ocean. What was your sense of the Prime Minister's first press conference after a great deal of contradictory information had come from the Transport Minister?
Well, I saw the press conference and I was actually quite surprised about the Prime Minister addressing this personally, this issue, and I think it just got to that stage because before that, his administration just really handled this whole incident really poorly, and so in many ways, I saw this as some kind of a face-saving exercise because they really showed their incompetence in how that was handled in the days before. So that was my first impression, that it really was some kind of a rescue operation of sorts for the reputation of the Malaysian government.
So, and this is a government that is authoritarian and apparently inept, but it's an authoritarian government. And the main political rival has been railroaded on trumped up homosexual charges, hasn't he?
Yes, I mean, this is a government that is in many ways a hybrid between a democratic government and an authoritarian government. So they really do have elections every couple of years. But then basically everything is done before elections that basically opposition figures or opposition groups really don't even make it to the elections. So in many ways, you could say, as you said in your assessment, that this is an authoritarian government and therefore probably just not used to the kind of scrutiny and critical examination that they're getting right now from the world media. And so the way they've reacted to this probably just shows exactly this.
But don't they have an economically powerful Chinese community in Malaysia that is obviously the population is dominated by Malays who are Muslim. They comprise 60% of the population. The Chinese constitute about 26%. And then Indians and indigenous people make up the rest.
Right.
So Given that the Chinese government is furious with the Malaysian government, how does that sit with the Malay community? Because the Chinese community, because aren't there been tensions between the Chinese community and the Malay majority going back to the early guerrilla wars of the 1950s?
Sure, but then also the deal has always been in Malaysia that since the Chinese, as you correctly point out, control most of the economy, the deal has always been that they are in many ways allowed to do that, and the price they pay is that basically it's the Malays that run politics, and so there really has been this coalition in power since the mid-1960s that consists of a Malaysian party, a Chinese party, and an Indian party. And there, the kind of relationship is very clear that it's really UMNO, the Malaysian party in that coalition, that really runs politics, and the Chinese, in many ways, are influential in business, in the private sector, but don't really have all that much to say outside that coalition that is dominated by the Malays in Malaysian politics. So in many ways, a very vulnerable kind of community, and therefore probably we also see that the Malaysian government probably hasn't responded to that in a more appropriate kind of way.
So in terms of the we've talked about the this being an authoritarian government who've basically silenced the opposition by labeling the leader of the opposition as a homosexual on trumped up charges. The previous prime minister, of course, was quite controversial, making anti-Semitic remarks. How much is Islam used in terms of politics? I know there was a ban on the use of the word Allah by non-Muslims that was overturned back in 2009. But that, of course, when it was instituted, sort of highlighted religious divides in the country, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, really, that has a long history in Malaysian politics. That basically, Islam is used as a political tool for all sorts of reasons. I mean, in many ways, the government under Prime Minister Muhammad Mahathir that you referred to before kind of mastered the art of using Islam for political ends. In the 1980s, we've really seen a kind of an emergence of religion in Malay society. People became more overly religious, and the Malaysian government really took advantage of this by expanding government programs for mosques, for example. They expanded subsidies for all sorts of religious programs, but then also in that kind of context, of course, defined how religion should be used and who can use religion in what kind of way. So in many ways, we saw in Malaysia an Islamization of the bureaucracy, and that really has its roots in a political strategy of that coalition that has been in power since the 1960s, which is dominated by Malays / Muslim Malay, of course. Yeah. So that's something that's been done for a very long time in Malaysia.
But this is not to say that the Saudi Arabian Wahhabi sect has had much traction. I mean, they've radicalized Indonesians, or some Indonesians, which led to the bombings in Bali by these al-Qaeda affiliates. But I believe the Indonesians have cracked down and eradicated most of these cells. Is there any evidence of Wahhabism, of Saudi sort of al-Qaeda-like Islam?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, surely a lot of these local groups that are rather radical are using maybe this discourse, or they're attaching themselves to this discourse, but we don't see, I think, an infiltration of Muslim communities in Southeast Asia by jihadis from the Middle East. I mean, a lot of these local radical Islamist groups have been around for a very long time, for decades sometimes, and a lot of these groups have the roots of their grievances are local and, as I said, historical. I mean, this is something that's been around for quite some time. It's not something recent. So a lot of these groups are homegrown, grievances are local. And then, as you pointed out, I mean, actually, a lot of these groups have been extremely weakened over the last couple of years, because a lot of these governments have been incredibly aggressive in going against local terrorism. And so therefore, a lot of these local groups, I think, don't really have the capacity or the competence to pull off a hijacking of a plane, if that really is what happened.
But there was a meeting that took place between a group of al-Qaeda terrorists in Malaysia that was monitored by Malaysian intelligence. And when the meeting broke up, two of the people at the meeting were tracked to Thailand, but the CIA lost them at the airport in Bangkok, and then they showed up in San Diego, and they were involved in 9/11, these two. And this was the case of the hijackers in San Diego who were getting money from the Saudi embassy or the wife of the Saudi ambassador. They were not the FBI were not told about them. They went on to be pilots of one of the planes. I think it was the one that hit the Pentagon. So there's some history there, right? I mean, but that's not to say, as you just said, that there's no real homegrown terrorist groups there. But is it possible that outside terrorist groups could use Malaysia because of some of the weaknesses in the system? I don't know much about Malaysian intelligence. Maybe you do.
You know, what is actually interesting is that also a lot of radical groups that are active in Indonesia or were active in Indonesia actually were hiding in Malaysia for quite some time. So they never really staged terror attacks in Malaysia, but basically stay in Malaysia for a considerable amount of time. They live in Malaysia. They establish networks in Malaysia, but then really, because probably also the rather oppressive government apparatus never really stage attacks in Malaysia. So sure, there is a milieu, so to speak, of radical groups in Malaysia. It may well be possible that some groups have people that are moving in that milieu, but I'd be very surprised if groups that are Malaysian or groups that are Indonesians are involved in this plane incident. So it could be that foreigners have used Malaysia as a transit zone, but I don't think that this is a group that is from Malaysia or from Indonesia or even from the Philippines that is responsible for this.
Well, one of the things that affects Malaysia and this region, from my understanding, is the ecological devastation that's going on, particularly in Indonesia with these fires, these constant forest fires where they're burning down the rainforest in order to grow palm oil. Apparently, the Malays are also doing that in Sarawak and Borneo, destroying rainforests and the area of Malaya and particularly Singapore often gets to the point where the air is unbreathable because of this. So in terms of the ecological devastation, are there political movements in both Indonesia and Malaysia, since the Malays and the Singaporeans have been the victims of all this smoke? One would think at some point or other they may be rethinking these policies.
Sure. I mean, they're protesting, right? The Singaporeans, every year, right, suffer from the kind of pollution that is coming over from Indonesia. Malaysians are suffering from this. But then the irony really is that most of the companies that are actually financing these operations in Indonesia are actually from Singapore or from Malaysia. So in many ways, it's also very hypocritical that these governments are blaming Indonesia for just burning down the rainforest while their very own private sector is actually financing these operations. So this is a very complex issue that goes across borders.
Well, maybe there should be a ban on palm oil then, if that's what they're, destroying the rainforest in order to grow palm oil plantations.
Sure, yeah. It's been discussed, right? But then there's also so much money in this. A lot of transnational companies, a lot of Western companies that have, millions of dollars invested into these operations. And so that usually is the bottom line, that you want to make money, and that is just one way to do that. And so therefore, I think that problem is just going to be around for some time to come.
Well, Michael Buehler, back to the hijacking of this plane, which, by the way, the Malay government, Malaysian government, still hasn't used the word hijacking for some reason or other. I don't know what the distinction would be, since it's clearly the plane shut off its communications and changed course. Now they're belatedly looking into the pilot and the co-pilot. You would have thought that would have been one of the first things that happened, but it didn't. So what's your understanding about, you know, how this is being discussed in Malaysia itself? The, you know, because the criticism from China is absolutely furious. But I'm just wondering how, what kind of Malaysian press you have, whether it's, since it's an authoritarian government, presumably they control the press.
Right. I mean, it could be that they've actually looked into the backgrounds of the I'm sure they've looked into the backgrounds of the pilots from the very start. I think, again, what the fact that they're just talking about this right now basically shows is that there probably is a lot of miscommunication within the government. There is probably a lot of rivalry within the government as well. The Malaysian government in many ways is heavily politicized as well, so you may have different factions that in many ways behind the scenes, moving against one another, and that probably has all an impact on a coordinated kind of way of responding to this incident. And so I think the fact that they're just now talking about that the pilots may actually have been involved probably is a consequence of that.
So just in closing, will this affect the Prime Minister's political fortunes?
I don't think so. I mean, he has a lot of other domestic problems, I think, that are, of more concern to him than this. This was just mishandled, but I don't think that within Malaysia this is actually going to make much of an impact, and also probably doesn't increase pressure on him all that much. No, I don't think so.
Right. Well, at least he's been able to get a stimulus package through to revive his economy, which is more than you can say for the U.S. government. I thank you for joining us, Michael Buehler.
Yeah, thanks a lot. My pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Buehler, who's a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society in New York City. He's contributed two political risk evaluations for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with an aviation safety expert about possible scenarios in terms of the fate of this Malaysian Boeing 777.
And smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Gleave, who is an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gleave.
Pleasure to be with you.
And let me begin by the caveat that I hesitate to talk. You know, there's been endless speculation, and a lot of it which is kind of ghoulish, about this aircraft disappearing, and one has to have empathy for that. The passengers, assuming everything that we've heard so far indicates a hijacking, and we don't know about their fate, and of course their next of kin are waiting, and perhaps with false hopes, because we don't know whether the plane landed and what's the fate of these people. So let's begin with that question. The fact that the plane, after it made this strange maneuver, went up to 45,000 feet above its ceiling, recommended ceiling. Would that indicate that they were deliberately asphyxiating the passengers?
No, the likely cause is that they maybe when they're taking control of the airplane, they're trying to get the maximum range out of the aircraft. And by climbing higher and higher, they may be seeking to get more and more range out of the aircraft. It just becomes less controllable when it goes to its service ceiling. It just means that it can't climb quite at the rate that it normally has to comply with air traffic control clearances. So the 777 can fly very high anyway. But I wouldn't add too much at the moment to that in terms of trying to considering asphyxiation of the passengers. The pressure will be fine inside the cabin. And then if there were a problem, the cabin masks would drop anyway. So the passengers would have about half an hour's worth of oxygen. But yes, I don't think that necessarily it's indicative just at this moment in time of trying to knock out potential hijackers, although it is one manoeuvre that can be used.
Well, we recall from the 9/11 tragedy that the aircraft that went down in Pennsylvania, the crew did take over. And, you know, obviously the questions arise if this plane was hijacked and if the pilots or some people aboard were complicit in this hijacking, then how did they subdue 200-plus passengers?
Well, it's a night flight. It's not a daytime flight across the United States. You don't have much in the way of visual references anyway because you're flying over the sea for quite a large period of time. It's not as dense as the United States is. So the first way of subduing the passengers is to put out an in-flight entertainment announcement saying they're terribly sorry, but certain functions don't work on the in-flight entertainment. And then you stop the moving map from working so the passengers don't know where they're going. That's the easy way to do it. And then after that, that will keep the passengers quiet for approximately the next 4 to 5 hours when they would then expect to be waking up heading for Beijing.
And questions about their personal cell phone or no evidence from cell phones, etc. How would you explain that?
Well, this is the hijackers, if it were to be a hijack, would obviously try and take off as many mobile phones off people as possible because they would be able to ping some of the ground stations and you'd get messages going backwards and forwards and being able to trace them. Obviously, they should be switched off. So it's more indicative of a takeover by somebody rather than a silent hijack. It's almost a silent hijack rather than a forced hijack. So this is why the psychological profiling of the crew is going on at the moment to see if they can find any evidence that any of the pilots was involved complicitly. Because then even some of the time when I've seen aircraft diverse, even the cabin crew don't realise where they're going to. So that would be the current theory that's being worked on with the highest probability of being correct.
So just, if you don't mind, David Glebe, tell me the difference between a silent hijacking and a forced hijacking.
Well, a forced hijacking would require people from the cabin to break through the cockpit door and then force the pilots to cooperate with their particular demands. We have had cases of crew hijacking recently, and we've also had cases of crew suicide recently. Now, in those cases, you don't need to, the passengers may not know what's happening or where they're going or what indeed their end fate is. So there'd be no reason for the passengers to suddenly start switching on mobile phones in the middle of the flight in order to try and get communication messages out as to where the aircraft was going. So I think in this case, we seem to be looking towards a silent hijacking rather than a forced team of six people taking over the aeroplane with guns in Hollywood movie style.
Again, I'm speaking with David Glebe, who's an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. So if this is the case, then if indeed it is a silent hijacking, the passengers aboard wouldn't have noticed then when the plane dropped down, apparently, to sea level. Is that according to the Malaysian radar tracking from Butterworth? That's my understanding.
Yes. I mean, the passengers wouldn't necessarily have noticed anything significant because you're really just listening to the rumble of the jet noise and the wind going past. So if it's been hijacked at night and you're over the sea, then you may see the odd flare from an oil rig or possibly some long off distant city. But in general, it's very black, the middle of the South China Sea. So the passengers wouldn't necessarily be aware of anything in relation to altitude at all, because they have no form of visual reference to be able to work with, which is also why you need to isolate the in-flight entertainment system. Otherwise, one or two people on board the aeroplane are likely to be quite aviation enthusiasts and start to question why they're flying at 500 feet rather than 37,000 feet, as you would expect at that period of the flight.
So what is your understanding then, David Gleave, of this ambiguity over the satellite that picked up the last signals, and because it's a geostationary satellite over the equator, over the Indian Ocean, it gave according to the Malaysian Prime Minister, two possible routes. One is south into the Indian Ocean, which doesn't make any sense. There's no reason why you'd hijack a plane in order to crash it into the ocean and drown, you know. But the one to the north, you know, makes more sense because it went over land. So what do you make of that?
I think you need to do psychological profiling on the crew to make sure that there is no financial or political reason why they would hijack the aircraft and crash it into the sea. I have worked on crew suicides before. I'm not saying it is necessary here, but you'd certainly want to do the psychological profiling of the crew, and you can see that going on at the moment because they've raided their houses and they're taking the possessions away and they're looking through computer files and things like that to see if there's any reason that they would choose to act in this manner. But yes, we have to look at everything political, religious, and financial at the moment. And that would explain a track that went off into the Indian Ocean, because if the aircraft is lost completely, you can't prove anything, and therefore there may be a reason that if you desired the insurance payout, then that would be a reason for doing so, because obviously insurance companies don't pay out if you commit suicide. But if you can't prove that it's suicide, then this is the way to do it. We also have the curve that's being drawn is the edge of coverage from the particular satellite. So it may well have moved since that point. So it could well be quite a large area to the west or to the east, but probably to the west of those the curves that you see in the media being drawn at the moment. I think if it's gone north, it's very strange that we haven't heard from it in any form at all. We wouldn't expect to hear at this stage from the insurance companies if it had been hijacked and the airframe has been subjected to, say, a $50 million ransom before it was released. Nor would we necessarily expect to hear from the Chinese embassy that they were negotiating the release of 200 of their citizens for a ransom fee. But it's very unusual that we haven't heard anything from any airport that they've had an aeroplane land unexpectedly, because obviously the whole world is looking for it. And you do need a reasonable size airport to not just land this aeroplane at, but actually to turn it around, refuel it and take it somewhere else. So the hijacking theory carries equal credibility for it's been stolen and hidden somewhere, or alternatively it's been crashed into the Indian Ocean for suicidal reasons.
So, but who would the beneficiaries be of an insurance policy?
The previous case I worked on, it was the family. There was a degree of financial distress within the family, large medical bills needed paying, and also elements of a loss of face and a loss of status by the person that's been considered as the main person likely to have committed suicide with the aeroplane, in terms of downgrading their status within. We have to remember this is Asian culture, not American culture, so we have to think slightly differently. But if you're going to lose your job or receive a significant demotion, then this can be the reason to be psychologically very upset, because your status is being reduced. If you happen to die in a plane crash fighting the aircraft like a hero all the way to the ground, then your family retains that status, you receive the insurance payout, and you address all the other financial difficulties that you may have been having at the same time.
So if any of that is relevant, presumably that will be determined through psychological profiles of the crew. But what about going the northern route? I mean, one of the things that some people are afraid of is that this plane could end up being used later, you know, by some kind of al-Qaeda type group presumably a 777 Boeing laden fully with fuel and stacked to the gills with explosives could be an extraordinarily dangerous weapon.
Yes, indeed, but it's not. If you wanted to do something like that, this is a very complicated, quite high-risk way of doing things. If you were trying to take an aircraft as large as this and hide it, then it really is quite difficult to hide such a large thing from U.S. intelligence satellites, Chinese intelligence satellites. And you need a big hangar to put it in. There's not that many hangars in the world are capable of housing a 777 if you were trying to land it and then park it. You would really want to know when the U.S. spy satellites and the Chinese satellites were going overhead, the particular airfield you're trying to divert to make sure they weren't taking photographs, and then land it and then park it up, say, at times when the satellites weren't overhead. So an awful lot of intelligence-related planning is required to be able to do that. The aircraft needs 60 meters to or 200 feet to be able to turn itself around. So you can't land it on just any particular tiny strip. It does need quite a wide turning circle and taxiways and things like that to be able to undertake this plan. And certainly I've seen aircraft stolen in the past to be used as freighters for drugs, but it would certainly be a very daring way of doing things to take over an aircraft this size. But there are aircraft that you could effectively just charter or buy out of the desert, which are as big as this, if you wanted to achieve the same objectives.
So this is a little bit too elaborate, you think, for that kind of scenario?
I think it's quite an elaborate scenario, particularly when you start to need to track U.S. spy satellite flyover times and things like that. Yeah, I mean, it can be done, but it would require an awful lot of intelligence planning to be able to do so.
That would imply, you know, a state intelligence. The only country that would be subject to that kind of speculation would be Pakistan, where the plane apparently, you know, it's one of the countries that it could have gone towards or over. That is a country that does have state-sponsored terrorism, but there again, that's a pretty militarized neighborhood, isn't it?
Indeed, and you would have seen, the Indians would have seen something. In order to get to Pakistan, it would have to go, or it may have gone close to India. And again, there's not that many places in Pakistan where you can actually hide this size of aircraft, because if you said it's gone to Pakistan, there's probably, I don't know exactly, but there's probably only two or three hangars within the entire country that are capable of housing such an aircraft. And then you have to use remote sensing technology on board the satellites to look inside the hangar to see whether it was actually there at the time. So, for example, if it's been flown there deliberately and you have spy satellites circling that area, you would look for infrared signatures of an aircraft of this size and see if the engines are still hot in the hangar if you can.
So
you would try and do so.
Sure. So, David Gleave, again, an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. So I take it then the most likely scenario, well, you mentioned the possibility of a suicide insurance scenario. What about a criminal scenario? I mean, you mentioned that. What would the advantage be? I mean, we're talking about $50 million. But if you ransomed out all of the passengers to the Chinese, I believe there were 153 Chinese, including a high-level delegation of Chinese artists aboard the plane. So presumably $1 million each. You get a substantial amount of money there, Ryan.
Yes. I mean, we've got to look at the type of ransom demands that are paid in Somalia when the pirates hijack oil ships and things like that. A new one of these aircraft is something of the reach of $250 million. This aircraft's about halfway through its life, so it's worth something like $100 million or so. So it's worth paying $50 million to get it back. However, it's been quite a long time since anybody has successfully hijacked an aircraft. Normally, you know, because it's diverted to a major civilian airport because it needs to be refueled to get to a country which you may be able to be in control, like Somalia or something like that. So it would be quite a daring attempt to have somewhere to land this aircraft and then from there to ransom it for $50 million. And it could just be for piracy purposes or indeed just as a form of getting funds for more terrorist activities. But whatever the reason, we would have expected to have found the aircraft by now if it had just landed somewhere at a normal airfield or even a military airfield or a disused airfield or anything like that. But it is, as you said earlier, is a very, very wide landmass area to search over, but certainly everybody in the world looking for it.
Well, just in closing then, David Glebe, what's your understanding of why the Malaysian government behaved in such an odd and apparently inept way? The Chinese government and of course the Chinese next of kin of the missing passengers are furious. Why, you know, the Malaysian Air Force had these radar tracks, I believe, last Wednesday from Butterworth, where they, you know, somehow they were, but they wasted a whole week in the wrong ocean, searching the wrong ocean.
Well, yes, I mean, we had the reports of the primary radar tracks, but if the military then have to coordinate with the civilian service, they want to give out real facts, and I doubt that they have the software and the teams capable of processing the radar picture and actually working out that it's a 777. They can say it's a large return, but it takes a degree of sophisticated processing, which is normally associated with military design of stealth aircraft, to work out what the cross-section is of the aeroplane that's reflected back by the radar and compare that with what you actually have measured. And yes, it was. We know that now that we think it's flown off to the west for an hour, but there's nothing to stop it having turned around and come back again. I think the most important thing was to search around the position of last contact and say, okay, we know, we're fairly confident it's not here. And you have to work on several theories at once. Certainly the Malaysian government have been releasing information as they see, as they know it. And there are always time delays when you have, for example, you have British investigators sort of 8 hours behind Malaysia, you have American investigators sort of 16 hours behind Malaysia, and then Malaysian time. So if you ask for technical help and it has to go back to the headquarters of any particular organization, it can take a day for the response to come back again, purely because this is a global situation that we're looking at.
So you wouldn't be too hard on the Malaysian authorities then?
Well, I think we also have to say that when you start to get politicians looking at things who are subject to being elected, and also subject to a culture where a loss of face is the thing you try to avoid, then I understand the behaviour, but from a Western perspective, we may find it a little bit strange.
Well, David Glebe, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Glebe, who is an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.